Well met, and welcome to episode 18, the Bill Shakespeare Project podcast for November the 8th, 2009. For our blog and previous podcast episodes, check us out at thebillshakespeareproject.com. Greetings. This is Bill Walthall, and this week we're going to kick off our month-long discussion of the second part of Henry VI. Last month we tried to do the entire plot in a single podcast, and that one took 30 minutes. It was a killer to record, edit, and download. So this month, with an even longer play, we're going to split the plot synopsis into two parts. And this week we'll tackle the first half of the play, plus we'll do our usual recap of this week's blog entries. Now the second part of Henry VI begins with pageantry. Only this time, instead of it being a funeral like it was in the last play, now we're dealing with a quasi-wedding. Henry is being introduced to his wife, who had been married in proxy to Suffolk. Remember, in the closing scenes of the first part of Henry VI, we see Suffolk taking Margaret prisoner, and then ambitiously deciding to pimp her off to Henry as queen. And at the end of the play, Suffolk more ambitiously planned to rule her, king, and realm. Suffolk presents the bride. Henry happily accepts, and the new queen promptly and correctly and politely curries favor, and naught can make poor Margaret miserable unless the frown of mighty England's king. And needless to say, Henry's a happy camper. And all is well until Suffolk hands Humphrey, Duke of Gloucester, the Articles of Contracted Peace. And they are so galling to the Lord Protector that he lets the paper fall. First, England must give up the areas of Anjou and Maine. Second, England has to pay for the shipping charges of sending Margaret to England. And third, she is without dowry. Henry, however, sees nothing wrong. The articles please us well, he says. And he immediately promotes Suffolk from Marquis to Duke. And it is only after Henry, Margaret, and Suffolk leave that Gloucester gets a chance to vent his disapproval to the remaining nobles. Now, as brother to Henry V, the last king of England to conquer France, Gloucester is upset about giving back lands. Of course, the handover of Maine and Anjou, in reality, is nothing to be concerned about. Both were the ancestral lands of Margaret's family, so this seems proper. Maine had been pretty much destroyed in the war, so there was nothing much to relinquish, and Anjou was never really occupied by the English, so their claim on it was in name only. Now, Cardinal Winchester immediately discounts Gloucester's claims. Anyone who has read the first part could have predicted this, and says that England won't lose France. Both Salisbury and Warwick bemoan the loss of territories won in the war. Richard, Duke of York, sides with the hawkish Gloucester as well. The Cardinal chides Gloucester more, but Gloucester leaves before getting pulled into their ancient bickerings. Of course, with Gloucester out of the room, the Cardinal goes on a relentless attack on the king's uncle, questioning his loyalty, calling him an enemy unto all, no great friend to the king, and an heir apparent with much to gain. Since Henry has yet to father a son, Gloucester is next in line for the throne. The Cardinal mocks Gloucester's high esteem with the common people and says that Gloucester will be found to be a dangerous protector. Buckingham agrees with the Cardinal and asks Somerset to join him to remove Gloucester from his seat. Before Somerset can answer, the Cardinal runs off to confer with the new Duke of Suffolk about this weighty business. In his absence, however, Somerset warns Buckingham against this haughty cardinal, who, if Gloucester is removed, would be protector. Buckingham then presents an alternative option. Somerset or Buckingham himself will be protector instead of Gloucester or Winchester. And the two cousins leave the stage, leaving York, Salisbury, and Warwick. Salisbury is stunned by this open statement of self-serving ambition, and he states that he is there to labor for the realm. Warwick agrees to work toward the common profit of his country, so the two Yorkists fall in line with the Lancasters, and one begins to wonder why the original title of this play was the first part of the contention betwixt the two famous houses of York and Lancaster. That is, one wonders that right up to the moment when York speaks, and so says York, and then in an aside says, for he has greatest cause. York will keep the country together, because he wants it all. Once Salisbury and his son exit the stage, we get to hear York in soliloquy, and he outlines his plan, sounding much like his own son, Richard, Duke of Gloucester, two plays from now. He's going to show love when he needs to, but when he spies an advantage, he's going to seize control and the throne of England. After he exits, enter Humphrey, Duke of Gloucester, and his wife Eleanor, who questions him on his gloomy mood. She asks what he sees on the sullen earth, and wonders if it is King Henry's diadem, enchased with all the honors of the world. And if it is the crown he sees, then her advice to him is to gaze on till his head be circled with the same. She goes on to tell how she is willing to help him achieve the crown. Gloucester, horrified by the thought, tells her to banish the canker of ambitious thoughts, then recounts to her the cause of his gloom, a nightmare in which his staff, the symbol of his position in the court, is broken, and onto each part are impaled the heads of Suffolk and Somerset. Eleanor dismisses the dream and offers up one of her own, one in which she is in seat of majesty, where Henry and Dame Margaret kneeled to her, and on her head did sit the diadem. But her husband is still disgusted by her ambition, and he chides her for being presumptuous and ill-nurtured and hammering treachery. After he leaves her alone on stage, she shares her thoughts and the kingly ambitions for her husband. If she was a man, she would get rid of all of her competition and pave the way to the throne on their headless necks. Before she leaves the stage, she calls for Hume, an ally and a priest, and she asks if he has yet conferred with Marjorie Jordan, the cunning Witch of Eye, and with Roger Bolingbroke, the conjurer. He has, and they've promised to raise a spirit to answer all her questions of the future. But when she leaves him alone on stage, we learn that Hume is no ally at all, but a double agent working for Suffolk and the Cardinal, against both Duke and Duchess of Gloucester, with the goal of Humphrey's fall. Next, in Act 1, Scene 3, we see some of the common people's support for Gloucester that Cardinal Winchester had noted earlier. Petitioners ready themselves to deliver their petitions to him, but it isn't Gloucester who happens by. It's Suffolk and the Queen, and they are the absolute worst audience for these petitions. The first is against the Cardinal's man, the second against Suffolk himself for enclosing the commons of a township, and the last against someone who claimed that the Duke of York was rightful heir to the crown. Queen Margaret calls these petitioners base cullions, tears their petitions, and sends them on their way. Interesting words she uses. In Shakespeare's day, cullion did mean a despicable or vile fellow, a rascal. But this was the secondary meaning. The primary meaning? A testicle. Classy lady, that Queen Margaret. She sends the commons packing, and she's alone with Suffolk, in whom she confides her disappointment in Henry, whom she assumed would have resembled Suffolk in courage, courtship, and proportion. She then attacks her new husband's piety. She doesn't want a celibate priest, she insinuates, but a real man in courage, courtship, and proportion. And it doesn't take too great a leap of scholarship to go from her use of the word cullion to take her use of the word proportion to mean relation existing between things or magnitudes as to size. And I'm not talking about the relative heights of these two guys, if you know what I mean. You know what I mean? I think you do. Suffolk understands completely and asks her to be patient until he can work her full content. Now, with such an assistant, she is more than willing to outline those she wants to destroy. Gloucester, Winchester, Somerset, Buckingham, York, and especially Duchess Eleanor. It's amazing that she explicitly names each and every one of her targets, but she does. Suffolk notes that he has already laid a trap for Gloucester and his wife, and this late complaint of the petitioners will make but little for York's benefit. And he outlines his plan. So one by one, we will weed them all at last, and you yourself shall steer the happy helm. Now, into this conversation come Henry and his nobles, discussing the Regency of France. The candidates are York and Somerset, and while the post is an honor, it seems that each is more than willing, eager in fact, for the other to take the post. Remember, the war in France is not going well, and having this on the resume may not be the best for later political advancement. This squabble, however, expands to Gloucester's protectorship as both Margaret and Suffolk, no surprise, call for his resignation. Winchester, Somerset, and Buckingham waste no time piling on. When Gloucester leaves to cool off, Queen Margaret drops her glove, and when Eleanor fails to pick up the glove, she accidentally mistakes the Duchess for a servant and boxes her on the ear. Eleanor storms off just as Gloucester returns, his collar being overblown, and with his new cooler head, he attempts to move the subject back to the original one, the Regency of France, and he puts his support behind York. But Suffolk wants to show some reason why York isn't the right man for the job. And surprise, surprise, the third petitioner arrives on the scene, The petitioner restates his claim that the man in question supported York's claim to the throne. The accused denies the charges. The fallout is simple. Somerset is named the French regent, and the petitioner and the accused will settle the matter in single combat. York's reputation is sullied, and now there is greater suspicion that he has designs on the crown. Which is true, but not for these reasons. Now in scene 4, the last scene of the first act, we see Eleanor's conjuration ambush. We meet the witch, Marjorie Jordan, and the conjurer, Roger Bolingbroke, and we see their handiwork as they bring forth Asnath, a spirit. Now, Asnath, in true oracular form, answers Eleanor's questions in the most ambiguous manner. To a question of the king's fate, the answer is, "The duke yet lives that Henry shall depose, but him outlive and die a violent death." Huh? Who's being deposed? Who's outliving whom? Who dies the violent death? Damn oracles. Now, as the spirit disappears, to thunder and lightning no less, York and Buckingham break in and arrest Bolingbroke, Jordan, Hume, and the Duchess. York sends Buckingham to deliver the news of the arrest to Henry and Gloucester, who are hawking at St. Albans. Now keep that name in the memory bank for later in the play. Now, Act 2 begins with the hawking party, and after some symbolic statements about falcons flying high, an analog for man's ambition, Winchester and Gloucester begin their usual sniping, this time with Queen Margaret joining in on the attacks on Gloucester, much to the dismay of King Henry, who says, "I prithee peace, good queen, and whet not these furious peers." And surprisingly, she stops. Now, the verbal tussle is interrupted by the mayor and the townspeople of St. Albans carrying a lame man called Simcox, all crying out that a miracle has taken place. It seems that Simcox had been blind until today. But through careful examination, Gloucester is able to determine that this is all a scam, that Simcox was never blind. It's a comic sequence, and at the end of it, even Queen Margaret is laughing. Now, this good time lasts exactly 4 lines. Then the Duke of Buckingham arrives with news of Eleanor's arrest. The news leaves Gloucester devastated. "Sorrow and grief have vanquished all my powers, and vanquished as I am, I yield to thee, or the meanest groom." As a man of justice, he can only give Eleanor as prey to law and see how things turn out. From here, the play returns to London to witness York attempting to gain support from Salisbury and Warwick. This scene's explanation of York's rationale and claim to the throne is much better and more straightforward than the Rose Briar scene in the first part of Henry VI. Like the Rose Briar scene, it's mostly for the audience's sake, not for the characters. Salisbury and his son Warwick would undoubtedly have known the situation. By the end of this short scene, York has secured their support, no surprise. Of more importance is the statement made by Warwick near the end of the scene. "My heart assures me that the Earl of Warwick shall one day make the Duke of York a king." Now, why is this important? Well, history will later nickname Warwick Kingmaker, as he is the key in the disposition and thus creation of two kings. Now, in Act 2, Scene 3, we see the sentencing of Eleanor and her occult cohorts. She receives banishment due to her being nobly born, and Hume, Southwell, Bolingbroke, and the witch Jordan are all sentenced to death. Now, historically speaking, Jordan, as a witch, was burned at the stake. Bolingbroke was hanged, cut down after strangulation, but before death, then drawn and quartered. Southwell died in prison, and Hume was later pardoned. Now, once the prisoners are taken away, Queen Margaret demands the resignation of Gloucester as Lord Protector. Gloucester resigns, places his staff, the symbol of his office, remember the dream, at the foot of King Henry, and leaves. Then the two combatants from the earlier petition enter for their duel. Both Horner, accused of stating that the Yorkist claim to the throne is right, and Peter, the accuser, are brought in, drunk by their neighbors. There are more laughs by the nobles at the expense of the commoners, and then Peter kills Horner in combat. Before Horner dies, he confesses treason. Now, Scene 4, the last of the second act, depicts Gloucester's goodbye to Eleanor as she is about to set sail for the Isle of Man under the guard of Sir John Stanley. Before the Duchess reaches Gloucester, however, she is forced to walk through the streets of London, wearing only a sheet, with her written verses, the answers from the spirit Asnath, pinned to her back, and taking the abuse of the public. When the two meet, however, we see a different side to Eleanor. She warns her husband to watch for traps by Suffolk, Queen Margaret, York, and Winchester. It is actually rather sweet. Gloucester responds, "Ah, Nell, forbear. Thou aim'st all awry. I must offend before I be attainted." He believes, naively, that only if he does something wrong can he be accused of anything. Now, less than 15 lines later, a herald comes to summon Gloucester to Parliament at Bury. and immediately Gloucester begins to suspect something is amiss, that possibly Eleanor might be onto something. And my consent ne'er asked herein before? This is close dealing. Well, I will be there. Now here we see both his suspicion at the secret, close dealings, and resignation at what is coming. Act 3, Scene 1, presents the Parliament at Bury St. Edmunds, to which Gloucester was summoned at the end of the last scene. It begins with Henry musing why his uncle is late. Queen Margaret pounces on this, saying that this is out of character, then recounts that of late his character has changed. The Duke is now proud and peremptory. Then she posits a reason for the change. Gloucester is near Henry in descent, and should Henry fall, he is the next that will mount the throne. She fears for her husband, a woman's fear, because there are dangers in the Duke. She admits that she may be wrong, and calls upon Suffolk, Buckingham, and York to refute her claims, otherwise Henry should conclude her words effectual. Suffolk concludes that Eleanor's witchcraft was actually Gloucester's fault. Either she began her devilish practices because of the Duke's subornation, or his mere position as the successive heir did instigate the bedlam brainsick Duchess. That's a stretch. Gloucester was next in line, and that incited Eleanor to learn witchcraft. Right. Actually, maybe that's how it did work out. Anyway, unsolicited, Winchester accuses Gloucester of devising strange deaths for criminal offenses. York even accuses Gloucester of raising taxes for the war while the money never made it to the front. Buckingham closes the dogpile with the ominous statement that these are petty faults to faults unknown. In other words, I can't top your crimes, but I'm sure there are worse ones. Just give me a minute. I'll come up with something really nasty. Now, Henry tries to argue against this, comparing Gloucester to a lamb or the harmless dove. Margaret attacks both notions with the same argument. Gloucester is not what he seems to be. And yet the launching point of the whole conversation was his change in behavior. Henry doesn't seem too bright. He doesn't catch on to this. Now, hot on the heels of her argument, Somerset, regent of France, arrives with horrible news. All of the French territories have been lost. Henry shrugs off the news with a simple, God's will be done. York, in an aside, registers his disappointment. After all, if he were to become King of England, he also might have a hope of being King of France. Gloucester then arrives, and Suffolk immediately arrests him for high treason. York recounts the crimes that the other nobles have brought up earlier in the scene, and when Gloucester explains and denies all, Suffolk responds by basically saying, sure, these crimes are easy to explain, but the bigger ones won't be. Of course, he doesn't name those charges, using a strategy from the Buckingham playbook. King Henry finally speaks and admits, my conscience tells me you are innocent. In a long speech, Gloucester attempts to warn Henry about these dangerous times, to which the nobles appeal to Henry to disbelieve the former Lord Protector. Appeals turn to direct order, and then to direct action, as Buckingham tells Winchester, Lord Cardinal, he is your prisoner. The king has no control, and he realizes it as they take Gloucester away, and he begins to leave himself and says, my lords, what to your wisdom seems best, do or undo, as if ourself were here. He leaves, bemoaning innocent Gloucester's arrest, but he does nothing to stop it, and he can't stop whining about it. Now, once he's off stage, the queen leads the charge in plotting Gloucester's death. The nobles argue over the merits and legalities, and finally Winchester takes command and will provide his executioner. Now, after they agree to the plan, a messenger arrives with news of an Irish rebellion, to which they will send York to lead the English forces, though York mockingly says that they should send Somerset since she had such great success in France. Of course, it's neither Henry nor Queen Margaret who approves this assignment. Suffolk states, why, our authority is Henry's consent. The secret government is now in charge. With the promise of soldiers for his Irish military campaign, York remains on stage while the others leave. In a scene-ending soliloquy, York reveals his plan. He will return from Ireland with an army, a mighty band. And in the meantime, he will foment rebellion in England using a man by the name of John Cade. York will have Cade assume the guise of the late John Mortimer and raise, in the commons' mind, the idea and supremacy of the Yorkist claim. If Cade is captured and tortured, York loses nothing. He gains public support for the Yorkist claim. If Cade succeeds with his rebellion, York can return from Ireland with an army to defeat Cade, and he'll look magnanimous and gain public support. Either way, he wins. Now, he leaves the stage at this point, and the scene and the act end. And that's where we'll leave off for now. Next week, we'll start with Act 3, Scene 2. And what happens then? Let's just say that the original subtitle of the play contains the phrase, "With the death of the good Duke Humphrey." But like I said, that's next week. Now, if you've enjoyed this podcast, but you haven't been following along with our daily blog entries this week, you've missed subjects including a wrap-up of the first part of Henry VI, a discussion of the composition and production order of the three Henry VI plays, including a discussion of their various titles, and of course, a more detailed plot synopsis. So, if you would like more in-depth discussions, or just want a daily fix, check out the blog entries at thebillshakespeareproject.com, or at our Facebook page, though the Facebook page is more for Shakespearean news than the daily discussions of our play of the month. Also, if you have any question or comment about this or any other Bill Shakespeare Project podcast or blog entry, you can always lob me an email at bill@thebillshakespeareproject.com. And of course, you can always join us again for our next podcast. We certainly hope to see you then. You've been listening to the Bill Shakespeare Project podcast for November the 8th, 2009. For our blog and previous podcast episodes, check us out at thebillshakespeareproject.com. And we shall see thee anon.